Trump administration is reportedly planning a major shakeup at the EPA, including slashing its staff and repealing major regulations. We discuss what that might mean for Colorado on this week's edition of the Power Gap Podcast. I'm co-host Jake Fogelman, and you're listening to the audio version of the show. If you like what you hear, please consider subscribing and sharing. And to check out the video version, head on over to powergab.org for new episodes every week. Enjoy! All right, ladies and gentlemen, welcome back to another episode of Power Gab, your go-to show for all things energy and environmental policy in the state of Colorado. I'm Jake Fogelman, joined as always by my co-host Amy Cook. This week on Zoom, we have a special episode, though, to bring a little bit of discussion of federal energy policy, a little update on some state policy, a little update on your recent travels, Amy, that also deal with energy policy. So why don't you give the listeners a little bit of an update before we get into our
Real quick, before we get to the good stuff, I was in Washington, D.C., Jake, over the last 3.5 days, and I got home late last night, so I begged out of the studio so that I could sleep in late today. Anyway, I was at the let me preface it with this. I go to these things so nobody else has to. But this was the National Association of Regulatory Utility Commissioners. It's called NARUC. And that's where all our PUC commissioners go to things like these kind of meetings and their policy meetings. Or this one was what's called the Winter Policy Meeting. It was in D.C. And I never saw them, but I understand based on the list of attendees that Eric Blank was there, as well as Tom Plant was there. And then I think there were a couple of people from Black Hills and from Xcel. I just say that as way of background. This is where all the utilities commissioners get together and they decide, they talk about policy and whatever else is going on. And this was a policy meeting, over 2,000 people there. So it was big. But I wanted to share with this because it turns out that USAID impacts NARUC. You think, what? How the heck can that be? I mean, there are utility regulators, but USAID is U.S. Agency for International Development. Well, as it turns out, NARUC has an international program because you need to help internationally. You have to help your local public utilities regulator in foreign countries. So you think, okay, so they're bringing electricity to poor people, to places that don't have it. Well, you would be wrong if you thought that, because they have core competencies. One of them is gender equity. So international aid, international, NARUC International has a gender equity competency. It also has a clean energy competency. So in other words, it's women bringing wind and solar to, you know, sub-Saharan Africa. I mean, there's more to it than that, but you get the drift. Well, so they announced in one of the general sessions that we were at that because of the, let's call it the drastic or significant reduction in USAID funding, that their entire international program is gone. So they are no longer spreading gender equity and wind and solar to sub-Saharan Africa or other places because their USAID funding is gone. And I will say this, of the staff of NARUC, that international program was 14 people, and it was the second largest program they had, thanks to USAID funding. So that program is gone. We'll see if it comes back, but I wanted to share that USAID touches even utility regulators.
A little bit of a scoop there from PowerGab. I'm like you said, I'm sure most people were unaware that their utility regulators were doing that sort of stuff with taxpayer dollars.
They don't even know that their utility regulators have an association, let alone that we're spreading gender equity and solar and wind to developing countries, but sometimes not even developing countries. It's just any country.
Right.
So Yeah, it's kind of an interesting little factoid that we learned at the NARUC meeting. And but I'm sure that we'll hear more about it. Anyway, I'll let you give your update, then we can introduce our guest.
That's right. Yeah, just very quickly wanted to touch on this for listeners because we discussed this in a very recent episode, and that is the nuclear bill, House Bill 1040. We talked about it passing committee for the very first time after three failed previous efforts to just plainly recognize nuclear energy on the same footing that wind and solar get under state law. Well, that bill has now officially passed the Colorado House of Representatives. I believe it was a 43-18 final vote to get it out of the House. And so it will now be heading over to the Senate to get its first committee hearing over there. So the nuclear bill is moving.
It's kind of exciting stuff. So I'll be there for testimony in the Senate. And of course, we'll keep everybody apprised of that.
Absolutely.
Okay, I'm really excited to introduce a longtime friend of mine, but he's probably the smartest guy in any room he walks into.
And, oh God!
And you all know the laugh probably if you touch energy and environmental policy. Of course, I'm talking about Meyer Nobel, who was just recently retired from the Competitive Enterprise Institute, one of my favorite national think tanks. There he ran the Center for Energy and Environment. And in 2016, he led the transition team for the EPA under then President-elect Donald Trump. I was proud to be a part of that. My capacity was just the digital and communications assets, while Myron and his team actually did the heavy lifting of policy work. But the reason we have Myron on is some interesting developments, and Jake said it earlier, we've talked about this. Sometimes there's that intersection between federal policy and the state of Colorado. And what does that mean for Colorado? We, you know, PowerGab is Colorado-centric. And so when we talk about something at the federal level, it always has some kind of a tie in to Colorado. Well, first of all, Myron also has a tie into Colorado. He's a graduate of Colorado College in Colorado Springs, and he's a Westerner at heart, having been born in Oregon. Myron, welcome to the show. We're excited to talk about the EPA and what it could mean possibly for Colorado and what it in the future.
Thanks for having me, Amy and Jake. Good to see you both.
And you're now with the American Lands Council, correct?
Well, that's a part-time job. I'm the chairman of it.
Okay. And that matters out here in the West because we have a significant amount of federal lands, although Colorado, not as much as some others.
Well, Colorado, remember, is only on the edge of the West. It's a Midwestern state as well as a Western state. So you've got the Great Plains, which were homesteaded. And people in Denver and on the Front Range, they always look west. They never look east.
No, that's very true. I grew up in Missouri. Trust me, I was always looking west. But understandable, if you came from the Midwest and then you saw the Rocky Mountains, you looked at Denver and said, I think I'll just park myself right here.
Right.
So two things that came up recently. I think the first one is this, because this seems to be a little bit more prevalent in the media as far as like the reporting on it, maybe a little bit more solidified is a better word. A significant reduction in the EPA staff. And the reason why that could matter to Colorado is that Denver is the headquarters for Region 8. And according to, I think it was GSA that I looked up, Colorado Region 8 has had as many as 700 employees in it. Big building down on Winecoop. Their atrium, they're very proud of it. It's a LEED certified building. If there's a 65% reduction in staff, that would mean probably at least a significant reduction in the regional offices, don't you think? And from your experience at the transition team, is that what we could be looking at, is a massive reduction in regional offices?
I hope so. My view is, and has been since the 2016 Trump transition, that the regional offices should be closed, not downsized, but closed. And the reason is because it was very hard for me, at least, to figure out what they were doing that wasn't being duplicated somewhere else. And so they're a sort of middleman between the headquarters in D.C. On Pennsylvania Avenue and the state environmental protection agencies, and every state has one. And most of the work of the EPA, for some of the laws that the EPA administers, Clean Air Act, Clean Water Act, and some others, most of the work that EPA is charged with, they've actually delegated to the state agencies to monitor and enforce. And so, and then federal grants, federal money goes from the EPA to the state agencies. So the states are really doing the EPA's work. And I guess one of the reasons for having regional offices is to have somebody closer, at least in 10 states, kind of looking over the shoulders of the state EPAs. But I think that now with all the electronic abilities that we have to communicate and all of the, you know, the kind of accounting that Elon Musk is doing with Doge, which you may call Doge, but I find that a sort of French pronunciation. I prefer the Southwestern Doge, as in get along little dogies. I think they don't need to have a bunch of people looking over the shoulders of state EPAs. They can do it all electronically. So I think we could eliminate all 10 of them, not downsize them. And you know, when you downsize an office, then it grows back again. So really the only way to shrink the size of government is to get rid of things.
So you said when EPA was established, there were no state DEQs or environmental quality offices. Colorado, it's called the Colorado Department of Public. No, it's Colorado Department of Public Health and no.
Public Health and Environment. Yeah.
Yeah. There's CDPHE, there's HCPF, Okay. So those things didn't exist.
Well, Californians did. California had a Department of Environmental Protection that predates the EPA.
Oh, okay.
So that's why California gets some special treatment under some of the laws that were passed around that time back in the early 1970s.
So they were the only ones, but then now every state has some kind of a DEQ.
Yes.
Department of Environmental Quality. And it's really just duplicative what it's doing with the EPA. So if they got rid of the regional offices, does that just mean that you, for instance, issue a block grant to a state for something, or and then maybe have one or two people somewhere remotely administering the grant?
Yeah, that's what's done now. I mean, the Clean Water Office in your state agency gets money from the EPA, the federal budget, to administer the Clean Water Act. And so, and of course, they're not the only ones who do it. There's duplication because we've got, for example, wetlands regulation under the Clean Water Act, and the EPA has joint authority with the Army Corps of Engineers because at the time when they thought that wetlands were going to be regulated, they thought that they would actually be wetlands connected to navigable waters like the Mississippi River or something. But now, of course, for a long time, we've been regulating, as a former colleague of mine at CEI always said, we're regulating the moistures of the United States. And so even places that don't have much water, like Arizona, have lots of wetlands. So I think, you know, there needs to be a lot of unwinding done. But in the meantime, let's just get rid of the EPA regional offices and then figure out where to go from there.
What do you think the chances are that we can do that this time around with Donald Trump?
I don't want to sound confident because, as you know, the beast here in Washington is has been poked before, and it hasn't, and it's slashed back with all its claws out. So, but I think Trump is much more determined this time. He knows a lot more, and he has a much the financial precipice that we're on as a country is not due to lack of tax revenue. It's due to the explosion of federal spending, and particularly not limited to, but particularly under President Biden in the last 4 years. So we have to downsize the size of the federal government and shrink the budget. And the only way to do that over time is to have many fewer employees, because if you cut their budgets but you keep the people in place, they'll continue to that it'll grow back as long as the and also all these EPA people are regulators, and one of the problems of the economy is overregulation, and the only way to have less regulation, I've come to believe or learn, is to have fewer regulators. So I think downsizing EPA by two-thirds is a good start.
Yeah, it sort of brings up a classic public choice problem. The more people you have that think of themselves as regulators, they have to consistently justify their existence so they continue
That's right.
issuing new regulations in order to stay in their position. Amy, I don't know if you had any additional questions you wanted to ask about this particular aspect of the EPA news that we
No,
want to discuss.
I guess the one thing I looked at is you'll have states that have these headquarters that will scream about it, of course.
Right.
Denver being, Colorado being one of them because it's downtown Denver, which is already suffering due to bad management. And of course, they'll blame this on Donald Trump. Forget the fact that businesses have been fleeing downtown Denver over the last 5, 6 years, any last decade almost. But here's the other thing too that I look at with EPA on the downsizing. They are doing programs that are totally unnecessary. And I think I've talked about this before. One of them is called citizen scientist or participatory science. Why is EPA in the spending taxpayer dollars to quote educate anyone about the science, and it's their preferred science, right? It's their climate science. It seems to me that that is unnecessary. One, it can be done in your basic local school, or if your DEQ wants to do it, they can pay for it. The state can pay for it. I don't know why federal taxpayers are having to pay for this citizen scientists, other than they want citizens to go out and look for polluters and then go tell on them so that the EPA can collude with the local DEQ, the state DEQ, so that they can get somebody under a consent decree. And yeah, I'm a little bitter about it because I've seen it in Colorado in the oil and gas industry. But I know a guy who's been under a consent decree since 1994 and can't get out of it. So it starts with these quote citizen scientists. So that's a program they should totally get rid of. Yeah, so we can move on to the next one, unless Myron, if you have any other pet programs in EPA that you'd like to see go away.
Oh, yeah, I've got a list, but we can move on.
The other big news that we wanted to talk about is that you're starting to see this pop up in increasingly in some news reports. That evidently there's discussions about revisiting the so-called endangerment finding at the EPA. And before I go too far, Myron, why don't you sort of tell our listeners what is the endangerment finding? Why would the Trump administration be looking at getting rid of it? And what do you think the chances are of doing so this time around?
Yes, well, the endangerment finding comes out of the Massachusetts versus EPA Supreme Court decision in 2007 that told the Bush administration that they couldn't decide not to regulate CO2 emissions, carbon dioxide emissions from power plants and cars and anything you burn using coal, oil, and natural gas, that they couldn't decide not to do that without considering it within the context of the Clean Air Act, and that they needed to go through the process to decide whether CO2 emissions, and of course CO2 exists naturally in the air at the level of several hundred parts per million, but it's growing because of our burning of coal, oil, and natural gas. They had to decide whether those increasing emissions endangered public health and welfare. And if they decided that they did, then they needed to regulate them, or they needed to decide whether the Clean Air Act was the proper vehicle for regulating both transportation vehicle emissions and power plant emissions. And the Bush administration punted, and then the Obama administration in 2009 made the first of several endangerment findings, and they said, yes, indeed, CO2 emissions are a risk, and they endanger public health and welfare. And so that's the basis for all of the EPA regulations, of which there are, you know, Obama started some, Trump weakened and repealed, weakened and redid them, and then Biden reinstituted new versions of the Obama regs. So we've got vehicle emissions, tailpipe emissions of CO2, which is the push for electric vehicles. And then we've got the closure of coal-fired power plants, which is the because of the so-called Clean Power Plan under Obama, and it's got a different name under Biden. So the question is, why do we need to repeal the endangerment finding? Well, there's this entire regulatory structure that's been created that's going to be very difficult to undo and obliterate unless the endangerment finding is withdrawn. And the reason is because the endangerment finding is incorporated in each one of these rules, the power plant rules and the vehicle rules. And those emissions or rules are not going to be easy to just get rid of. I think that the Trump administration can weaken them and make them not as economically damaging. But unless they get rid of the endangerment finding, there's going to be a continued problem. So that's the reasoning. And President Trump, in one of his energy executive orders, told the EPA administrator to talk to his colleagues in the heads of other agencies and provide recommendations in 30 days, that is by February 20th, on what to do about the endangerment finding. So that's where we are. And he apparently, Administrator Lee Zeldin did make those recommendations. It's been rumored and it's been reported that he has told the White House that, yes, please go ahead and let's go ahead and reconsider the endangerment finding. But it hasn't been officially announced, and it's not clear when it is going to be officially announced. But that's really everything else I know about the current state is really a rumor.
Okay, so the endangerment finding is really the linchpin in this sort of house of regulatory cards.
That's right.
And so you pull that out, and a lot of the regulations on which some of this bad policy is built upon, that there is no foundation without the endangerment finding. Is that what I'm hearing?
That's right. And the endangerment finding used a lot of science, a lot of scientific reports. The EPA doesn't really do science, but they got scientific reports from the National Climate Assessment and the UN Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. And they said, well, yes, it's clear. And so undoing it, with reconsidering it and withdrawing it is going to be a difficult process, because the scientific consensus science is that global warming is a threat. And so I think this is a big lift. It's not going to be easy. It's going to take some time, and it will be litigated in court for probably several years. But I think, as you say, it's the linchpin, and I think it's really necessary if we're going to get past this morass of pointless, ineffective, and extremely expensive regulations that are really hampering the economy. And it's also connected to all of these subsidies, right? You've got the regulations from EPA, and then you've got the so-called Inflation Reduction Act subsidies for wind, solar, carbon capture and storage. All of these things are, you know, they're destroying the auto industry, and they're destroying the grid and raising electric rates. So this is, I think this is a very important piece of solving those or getting rid of those problems.
You sort of touched on one of my questions about this, just in terms of how, if they were to pursue this thoroughly, it would be a long drawn out sort of process. I'm assuming it would have to go through sort of a notice and comment rulemaking, Administrative Procedures Act sort of situation to actually go through it. One, is that correct? And two, does that open up the potential to kind of gum up the works with lawsuits from people challenging this sort of a thing?
Yes, you're right. Jake, there will need to be a proposed rule, a comment period, a final rule, and then lawsuits. And so which will go directly, they won't go through district court. Nobody's going to be able to file one in, you know, the Denver courthouse. It'll be the DC Circuit. So the DC Circuit is under the Clean Air Act. All appeals go directly to it. So, it won't take as long to get to the Supreme Court because it'll just be one step away from an appeal to the Supreme Court. But yeah, it'll still take some time.
So what does this mean, Myron? Let's say it gets through all of that. 4 years, good luck, but maybe. Let's say it gets repealed. The endangerment finding gets appealed, you know, taken back. What does that mean for states like Colorado that have already codified this stuff into state law? I mean, they're going to go over the cliff. They just don't have the federal boogeyman to blame.
Yes, the genius of our federal system is that states that want to do stupid things can do them, and states that don't want to shouldn't be required to do so. And the problem with a lot of federal regulatory legislation is it hamstrings the states so that they all have to make the same stupid decisions. So I think, yes, if California and the West Coast states and Colorado and the Northeast states want to continue to go ahead with trying to reduce CO2 emissions, they can do that. But you know, I think reality is starting to set in as people see that, first of all, we've already reached the so-called critical threshold of 1.5 degrees. Centigrade warmer the global mean temperature than it was 100 years ago or whenever the basis for that is, and you know, we're still, you know, doing okay, and the sunshine seems good on a winter day, even though it might be a couple degrees warmer than it was 20 years ago. And emissions haven't gone down globally because China, we've outsourced all of our heavy manufacturing, and in Europe even more so, to China. And what do they have? They don't have, well, yes, they have a lot of windmills and solar panels, but they have huge numbers of coal-fired power plants, modern, up-to-date, recently built coal-fired power plants. And in fact, they've announced that this year, they're going to build more new coal-fired power plants than any time in the last 10 years. So that's why global emissions keep going up, because we are not manufacturing energy-intensive goods in this country. We're importing them from China. And so, you know, California, it doesn't matter because their economy got rid of all that a long time ago. But for the rest of the country, I think it matters that we still make things and rather than import them from China. And if we want to continue to make things, we're going to have to get rid of these CO2 emissions rules, because wind and solar power cannot power a modern economy. That you know, the lights aren't on all the time if we continue to build more wind plantations and solar plantations.
I want to ask one more thing, and then Jake, you can take it from there. But Mike, you said something about the Inflation Reduction Act and the subsidies. And so now I'm going back to 2009, when the endangerment finding was it rolled out under the Obama administration. So it seems to me, and this would certainly, Colorado could be a case study in this, but that was originally going to be the start of the increase in energy costs. When that endangerment finding came out, there had to be the requirement to comply with it was going to be a significant cost driver. Colorado was only, you know, too happy to start the next year. In fact, within a few months of the endangerment finding being released, Colorado was already mandating fuel switching from coal to natural gas and wind and solar. And looking at that then, we had predicted costs are going to go up, reliability will go down. And as Colorado has continued on that path, costs have continued to go up. And in fact, faster than the rate of inflation and faster than the rest of the country even.
Yeah. Well, Amy, I think this whole global warming debate has been, first of all, it's not been based on scientific facts. It's not been based on data. It's been based on computer models. But on the one side, it's been based on alarmism. That is, that the sky is falling and we're doomed if we don't, you know, kill the Industrial Revolution, essentially. And on the other hand, it's been happy talk. And I think you've seen in Colorado probably as much happy talk as anywhere in the country, because there's been one kind of fly-by-night renewable energy company after another, and one lefty, you know, research analytical firm to tell you all that, oh, this'll work, and it's cheaper. You know, a windmill is free. You don't have to buy any fuel. It's free. That's what Al Gore said. You know, we should stop using expensive, dirty fuel and start using clean, free fuel like the wind and the sun. Well, it turns out that that's just happy talk. So on the one hand, we've got this alarmist sky is falling. We're doomed if we don't change our ways and repent. And on the other hand, we've got happy talk that it'll all work out. And yet nobody in the utility sector has ever done a study that actually shows how it can work and how much it'll cost. And now we're finding out that it's very expensive. And it's, you know, we're deindustrializing Germany. Germany is deindustrializing itself. And parts of the United States are. So, yes, I think Colorado has been in the forefront of this, of the happy talk.
Yeah, I say happy talk is a nice way of putting what's been going on down here in Colorado. But as we're coming up on time here, Myron, I want to give you just a second if you wanted to promote anything or any parting thoughts for our listeners, and then we'll kick it over to Amy to do the wrap-up.
Well, thanks for having me. I don't really have any parting thoughts. I think we've covered those two issues, and we gotta keep working on them. They're not the forces of darkness are not going to give up without a fight.
Absolutely. Amy, do you have any takeaways from this episode for our listeners?
Yeah, I'm actually excited about the prospect of 2/3 of the EPA. I mean, if we can't do it now, we'll never do it. Let me put it that way. This is the moment for us to downsize the EPA and show that a federal program can be rolled back, I think, and we have to. So I'm actually kind of excited, or let's put it this way, I'll be interested to watch it. That's number one at the federal level. And then two, keep your eye on nuclear in Colorado. It could be the actual happy talk, that as opposed to, you know, unicorns and magic fairy dust, we could actually have nuclear considered in our portfolio, which is a big deal in the state of Amory Lovins, who I think is public enemy number one when it comes to reliable power. And then last thing, I'm not going to say don't get a generator yet. I still think you should invest, because Colorado still hasn't built a nuclear power plant. We're just considering the fact that we may be able to have one. We can have nice things, and that includes a generator.
Yeah. Normally, I finish by echoing your final takeaway, but I also want to echo your first one this time. Make federalism great again. Here to that.
NAFA. Yeah. No, be different than that. Okay.
But that does it for us on another episode of PowerGab. If you folks liked what you saw here today, you can head on over to powergab.org to check out our entire back catalog. We produce new episodes every single week. We're also available wherever you get your audio shows, whether that's Spotify or Apple. And if you'd like to reach out to us to suggest future show topics or special guests you'd like to see us interview, you can send those over to info@powergab.org. We'd love to hear from you guys. But until next time, we'll see you.
If you've enjoyed this episode of Power Gap, I hope you'll share it with a friend.
Or even an enemy.
You can listen to more episodes on all of your favorite streaming services. We release a new episode each week.
If you have a question, comment, or suggestion for a show topic, email info@powergab.org. And to watch the video version, just search the letters IITV for Independence Institute TV on YouTube for this and many other great conversations.